This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, December 3rd, 2001. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Israeli missiles rained down on Arafat's headquarters in the Gaza Strip. Dozens of peace activists walking from Washington have arrived in New York to make their case against the war in Afghanistan. And some police departments across the U.S. are refusing to cooperate with FBI probes of Middle Eastern immigrants in the war against terrorism.
These are not suspects. These are not terrorists. These are people about which there is no reason to believe that they are involved in or associated with criminal activity.
But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Human rights advocates are concerned that the talks in Germany, orchestrated to create a new government in Afghanistan, may replace one set of abusers for another. Charles Michael Ray has more from Bonn.
Vikram Parikh, who covers Afghanistan for Human Rights Watch, says the new Afghan government created in Bonn must not include those who are responsible for past human rights abuses.
These aren't powers that came into Afghanistan on the basis of a popular mandate. So it's difficult in any such circumstance to guarantee human rights without legitimacy.
Over the weekend, the Northern Alliance faction at the talks put forward a new proposal on the creation of an interim administration that would take power in Kabul for the next 6 months until an emergency Loya Jirga, or traditional council of Afghan elders, can be convened to lead the way to a permanent government. While the factions debate over the names who will be involved in the interim authority, a coalition of democratic groups at the talks say they have been left out. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Bonn.
The U.S. military is planning to launch another test of its so-called missile defense program from Vandenberg Air Force Base. Ed Rippey reports from Northern California.
A test of the U.S. land-based missile defense system has been delayed for 2 days by bad weather and is now planned for tonight sometime between 9 p.m. and 1 a.m. Pacific time. The tests have often failed. Critics of the program say it violates the anti-ballistic missile treaty and doesn't even address credible threats to U.S. security. China has warned that it will be forced to build more missiles if the shield is deployed. The U.S. has said it needs to defend itself against limited missile attacks from small states of concern. In California, this is Ed Rippey for Free Speech Radio News.
Workers at one of the U.S. Air Force's major jet engine suppliers have voted to go on strike to keep their jobs in the United States. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven, Connecticut.
5,000 workers at Pratt & Whitney in four Connecticut cities went on strike at midnight last night. The workers overwhelmingly voted to strike after contract negotiations broke down between the company and the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. The union official said the workers are seeking job security and better retirement pay. Now a worker with 30 years' service gets a pension of just over $16,000. The rejected contract would have allowed the company to move 500 jobs out of state. Pratt & Whitney management criticized the union strike vote at a time when civilian airlines are in crisis and the U.S. is at war, with the majority of its aircraft powered by Pratt & Whitney engines. In New Haven, Connecticut, I'm Melinda Tuhus for Free Speech Radio News.
The nation's largest energy broker, Enron Corporation, filed bankruptcy papers. Aaron Glantz has more.
Bankruptcy came quickly to Enron. In the first 3 months of 2001, the energy trading company increased its profits by 300%, but the company didn't achieve those profits by producing electricity or by running power lines to America's homes and businesses, consumer advocate Doug Heller.
What Enron did was buy and sell electricity in our market purely for the purpose of skimming money off the top for themselves. They brought nothing. They created money out of nothing. They were buying and selling electricity like it was a pork belly on some commodity exchange, when the fact is, it's a vital service that keeps our economy running.
Enron lobbyists help write California's electricity deregulation law, and while allegations that Enron illegally overpriced its stock brought down the Houston-based company, consumer advocates say the deregulation scheme the company advocates continues to boost the profits of its competitors at the expense of consumers. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in San Francisco.
And finally, today marks the 16th anniversary of the Union Carbide chemical spill disaster in Bhopal, India. Sputnik Colombi reports.
In the middle of the night on December the 3rd, 1984, over 40 tons of methyl isocyanate and other lethal gases leaked from the American corporation Union Carbide's pesticide factory. 8,000 people were killed in its immediate aftermath, and over 500,000 people suffered injuries. Many of the people who survived the terrible night died slow and painful deaths in the years following the disaster. The current death toll is well over 20,000. Last year, a federal judge in New York dismissed a suit brought by survivors' organizations accusing Union Carbide of grave international law and human rights violations. Human rights groups here in India have also accused the Bhopal state authorities and the New Delhi government of continuing indifference to the plight of the survivors. In the 16 years since the gas leak, there's been no official commemoration of the Bhopal disaster, though the government observed a two-minute silence in memory of the WTC victims. Sputnik Kilambi in India for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
A large fire burned around the headquarters of Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat today after Israeli helicopter gunships fired missiles at the building, sending a plume of smoke rising over the city. Israel has fired missiles several times in the past near the Arafat offices, which are located by the beach in Gaza City. Inigo Gilmore has details from Jerusalem.
Israeli forces have carried out a series of airstrikes on Palestinian targets in the Gaza Strip and West Bank towns of Bethlehem and Jenin. Palestinian officials said the attacks were a declaration of war. The strikes come after a weekend of bloodshed in Israel, where 26 people were killed in a series of suicide bombings. A senior Israeli official said the strikes were just the beginning of Israel's response to Palestinian terror attacks in recent days. The Palestinians say the attacks are futile and will only lead to more bloodshed. The airstrikes began late in the afternoon in Gaza, where Israeli Cobra helicopter gunships symbolically fired missiles at Yasser Arafat's headquarters, destroying two of his helicopters and other buildings within the compound. Arafat was not there at the time. Later, two Israeli warplanes fired missiles at the Palestinian police headquarters in the West Bank city of Jenin. The strikes, Israeli military officials said, were a message to Arafat, whom the Israeli government has charged with being responsible for the latest spate of terror attacks. Inigo Gilmore for Free Speech Radio News, Jerusalem.
The American hunt for Osama bin Laden appeared to have gone tragically wrong for the second time in 2 days yesterday, when U.S. bombers were reported to have killed scores of civilians in eastern Afghanistan, as well as friendly Mujahideen fighters supporting their battle against al-Qaeda. A senior Mujahideen commander said U.S. strikes killed more than 100 civilians around Agam, 25 miles south of Jalalabad, on top of at least 70 killed in air raids on Saturday night. The U.S. military denied the claim, saying the bombing did not happen. Live bombs and unexploded munitions have become a way of life for Afghanis, unimaginable to most of us. How would you feel if a bomb left a huge crater just next to the playground where your children go every day? Or if a bomb disposal expert interrupted your breakfast to search your home and tell you that an unexploded 500-pound bomb was on the premises? These are scenes of everyday life in Kabul. Thanks to the U.S.-British bombing raids on Afghanistan, experts estimate that 30 civilians died during the raids, a result they describe as not too bad but tragic for those who lost relatives or friends. UN demining experts who were already trying to clear Afghanistan of millions of landmines left after decades of war have taken on the new task of clearing unexploded ordnances from the city. They recently took journalists to two bomb sites. Tony Cross accompanied them.
We're standing in front of a house which only has the front wall of the ground floor left. Inside, everything's pretty much ruined. A bit of the back of the house still left. And around it, a number of houses which have been partly affected. In the street in front of the house, there's a mortar and not very good at ordnance, but I think a machine gun. We're dragged out of the second house, which most of which is still standing. The investigators say that that proves that the bomb hit the right target. That person in the house which was direct hit was a head of police for the Taliban, and that next to it were Arab volunteers, jihadis, who had come to fight for the Taliban in Afghanistan. They say that that's proof that this was the right target. Nobody's sure how many people have been killed. Nobody's sure if the Taliban head was in the house at the time. Opposite the street, behind a bunch of trees, is a hospital, the Indira Gandhi Hospital. As Russ Chamberlain of the UN Mine Action Center for Afghanistan says, if it had gone wrong, it would have gone really wrong.
But one of the major reasons we brought you here is to show you this as a target, but we really wanted you to look behind you, and that's the hospital. So they had to be spot on to hit this. If they were wrong, there was going to be a big problem. So we brought you here just to see that they did this one right.
How many of these good examples are there? This is one.
This is one. There's not too many good examples. There's more bad examples than good examples.
Well, compared to the last building, this was obviously a lot more fragile because this has been completely flattened. There's just a load of rubble, mud bricks, dust, lots of dust. Now we're going to go over to Peter Lesueur of the Afghan Ordnance Clearance Organization.
This was a house that had a family of 10 Afghans in it, and they were all killed when a guided bomb, we believe it to be a guided bomb, went astray and hit the house. The bomb was probably aimed at the military post on the hill, a possible last-minute malfunction of the guidance unit, and it's probable that that's what happened to the bomb, and instead of hitting the military post, it hit a house with a family of 10 Afghan civilians. What it could have been is the bomb has a steering mechanism on the front. There could have been a malfunction in the computer guidance unit or a malfunction in the steering unit, which meant it was probably on target for that post. A last-minute malfunction could have caused it to overshoot the target. Then in a direct line, it came down and hit the house.
She said, what's going to be my future? I don't know what to do in the future. I'm all alone here. I have nobody living. You want to ask some questions?
I want to know who she is.
Her family died in this bombarding. Yeah, this is her house, and her husband and her son and family died in this bombarding. 8 people of her family died. Mm-hmm.
The United States bombing raids are only the latest violence perpetrated on this country. Decades of war have left 735 million square meters of land covered by unexploded ordnance. Those mines and other bombs kill 10 to 12 people every day, the UN experts say. Tony Cross for Free Speech Radio News in Kabul.
A growing number of police departments and officials across the U.S. are questioning the Justice Department's request to investigate 5,000 Middle Eastern immigrants as part of the federal anti-terror probe. Among the latest cities to voice objections to the interviews are Detroit, Michigan, Richardson and Austin, Texas, and San Francisco and San Jose, California. Last week, Portland, Oregon became the first of these cities to announce that it would not participate. From Portland, Catherine Comp has more.
Last week, Portland, Oregon became the first city in the nation to turn down Attorney General John Ashcroft's request to help interview Middle Eastern immigrants as part of the federal anti-terror probe. Some 200 will be interviewed in Oregon, nearly 5,000 nationwide. 3 other Oregon cities have also announced they will not conduct interviews. But the state is deeply divided on the issue. Oregon Attorney General Hardy Meyers and Governor John Kitzhaber have called on Oregon cities to assist the Justice Department. But 4 Oregon cities, Portland, Corvallis, Hillsboro, and Eugene, say that while they enthusiastically support the efforts to fight terrorism, legal statutes and limited resources prevent them from fully participating in the investigations. Portland Mayor Vera Katz.
There is no question that we must fight terrorism. In fact, the city of Portland efforts in fighting terrorism predates the September 11 attacks. We can fight terrorism aggressively and protect the legal rights of Oregonians at the same time. It is not that hard if you follow the law.
Katz has joined forces with City Attorney Jeff Rogers and Police Chief Mark Croker in defending the controversial decision not to help federal investigators conduct interviews of foreign visitors. Rogers recently approved an opinion prohibiting Portland police from conducting interviews with the people included on the federal list. Two Oregon legal statutes prevent law enforcement officers from collecting information about the political, religious, or social views, associations, or activities of any individual or group not suspected of or involved in criminal activity. Rogers found five areas of questioning issued by the Justice Department to violate these Oregon laws. He explains with an analogy.
Let's assume that while we're having this meeting, a violent murder is committed on the street outside, and the Portland police decide they want to interview people who might be witnesses. They could come here and come to the homes of every one of us and ask us all kinds of questions about what we saw or heard. You were sitting in the room up there, their windows. Did you see anything going on? Do you know anybody? Do you associate with these kinds of people who we suspect of crime? Do you know anything that will help us in this interview? What were you doing at the time occurred? Where were you at the time the crime occurred? But they can't then say, now, let me ask each of you about yourself. What activities do you engage in? What are your future plans for schooling, for travel? They couldn't ask those kinds of things about you or me or us because we were just sitting here. And from the law's point of view, we're in the same position as those people on the list. These are not suspects. These are not terrorists. These are people about which there is no reason to believe that they are involved in or associated with criminal activity.
Rogers was specifically concerned with suggestions that the interviews include checking visas to verify dates, obtaining all telephone numbers used by the individual and his family or close associates, and questions regarding roommates of the individuals, travel to Afghanistan, interest in visiting the United States, and sympathy to terrorist causes. Rogers, Katz, and Portland Police Chief Mark Croker say that Portland's decision has been widely misunderstood, not only by the national media, but also by politicians and law enforcement. In rebuffing accusations that Oregon is soft on terrorism, the three Portland officials have reminded critics that Portland joined the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force in 1999. Chief Croker defends Portland's position.
People have said, you know, aren't you being un-American or not less than patriotic? You know, you absorb this in a personal way. And so what could be more American than giving deep allegiance to the law? What could be more patriotic? You know, we pledge allegiance to the flag and to the principles which, for which it stands, and those principles are embedded in the law that made this country what it is.
Federal, state, and local agencies are carrying out the interviews in cities where Oregon police departments have declined. Even though these controversial investigations continue, civil rights groups are applauding the commitment to uphold constitutional principles. David Fidanke, executive director of the Oregon American Civil Liberties Union.
Portland's action is highlighting how inappropriate this phase of the Justice Department investigation is. The Justice Department should be held to a higher standard. What I hope is that this will help deter the Justice Department from engaging in this kind of a dragnet approach as the investigation continues. This is not about whether everyone in America, whether they're citizens or non-citizens, wants to prevent future acts of terrorism. Everyone wants to prevent terrorism. The question is, are we going to carry out this effort in a way that's consistent with the Constitution, in a way that we will look back on in future years with pride, or will we look back on these times with shame in the same way we look back on the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II?
From Portland, Oregon, I'm Catherine Kump for Free Speech Radio News.
Several dozen peace activists and survivors of victims of the September 11th terrorist attacks arrived in New York City on Sunday in the culmination of a week-long walk for healing and peace that began in Washington, D.C. Carrying signs reading "No More Victims" and "Our Grief Is Not a Cry for War," they call for a peaceful solution to the conflict in Afghanistan and an end to the cycle of violence. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Scott Gurian reports from New York.
September 11th was the 30th anniversary of Father Michael Duffy's ordination as a Franciscan priest, so he was surprised when he received a phone call that afternoon that his close friend Michael Judge, a chaplain for the New York City Fire Department, had been the first person found dead at the site of the World Trade Center. In the weeks and months following that fateful day, Michael Duffy has been an outspoken critic of the war in Afghanistan, calling instead for peace and restraint.
My friend Michael Judge would abhor what's going on. He was kind and loving, and he wouldn't want one person to even suffer, let alone die, for anything that happened to him. And I think that if all those people who died, the thousands of people that died, especially from their vantage point now, would be asked that question, are we doing what's right, and do you want us to kill other people in your name? Not one of them would say yes. Not one of them. So why are we doing it?
Duffy was just one of several friends and family members who lost loved ones on September 11th that took part in last week's peace walk, organized by the Chicago group Voices in the Wilderness. David Petorti's brother Jim worked on the 95th floor of World Trade Center Tower 1 and is suspected to have died in the initial impact of the first airplane. But as David witnessed the country's military response to the terrorist attacks, he says he felt a certain solidarity with the civilian victims in Afghanistan.
I don't particularly feel like an American right now, and I don't say that to be anti-American or anything like that, but I just feel like I'm part of this community of victims, that I have something in common with people that have suffered in the same way all over the world. And that's not something that has divisions of nationality or race. You know, we're all in this together. You're either down here when the bombs fall, or you're up there. And it doesn't really matter if you're down here who's dropping the bombs, because you're still down here and you're still dying.
The Walk for Healing and Peace traveled through Maryland, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey before crossing the Brooklyn Bridge on Sunday and entering into downtown Manhattan for a gathering at Union Square Park. Among the stops made along the way was a mosque in Paterson, New Jersey, where local activists joined for a candlelight vigil for peace. Nabil Abbasi is president of the Passaic County Islamic Center.
You can just feel it just by their presence here. You can just feel their authentic feeling, and their intention is very, very pure. I think this is something that we do need in this country. People are too either right or too left about what's going on, and they're right in the heart of the feelings.
At a press conference in New York today, the marchers revealed that plans are in the works to create an organization of victims' relatives demanding peaceful resolution to the conflict in Afghanistan. Amber Amundson, whose husband Craig was killed in the Pentagon, reads from a letter she addressed to President Bush shortly after the attacks.
I do not like unnecessary death. I do not want anyone to use my husband's death to perpetuate violence. So, Mr. President, when you say that vengeance is needed so that the victims of 9/11 do not die in vain, could you please excuse Craig Scott Amundson from your list of victims used to justify further attacks?
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Scott Gurian in New York City.
We are not afraid.
Another World AIDS Day came and went Saturday, and the news from Africa isn't good. So far, just over 28 million people on the continent have been infected with HIV, and over 13 million children have been orphaned by the disease. Sub-Saharan Africa is by far the worst affected, with 70% of the world's new infections in 2001. From Kinshasa, correspondent Rupert Cook takes a look at AIDS in the Congo.
Until the early 1990s, the Democratic Republic of Congo, or Zaire as it was then known, had one of the most effective programs in Africa for raising HIV/AIDS awareness and monitoring the spread of the disease. With the gradual degeneration, economic mismanagement, and corruption of the regime of the late former President Mobutu, the foreign donors stopped the funds. With the ensuing and ongoing war in the DRC, much of the good work from the past has been undone. Due to the war and the consequent inaccessibility of much of the country, there are few reliable figures for the disease's prevalence. Leonard Tapsoba is country representative for the World Health Organization in Kinshasa.
I know that maybe 70 to 80% of the population are aware about AIDS. But you know how to change your behavior. This is the challenge. The people are aware, but the behavior is not changed. So we have to work hard to try to get the reasons why they didn't change their behavior. They know the consequences of AIDS.
The DRC's government now reckons that HIV/AIDS is one of the most serious challenges facing the country. Mashako Mamba is the DRC's Minister of Health.
La prévalence du sida a été augmentée par deux phénomènes.
The increase of AIDS incidents are augmented by two factors. First, people and families are moving around a lot to find the means of survival. And the second is desperation and poverty leads to promiscuity. This endangers all members of the family and society. The task of this country is to make use of whatever means are available.
I'm with Marlene de Tavernier, who is the coordinator of the Sexually Transmitted Diseases and AIDS program with MSF Belgium in Kinshasa. Are many young women forced into occasional prostitution?
We see that more and more this category is increasing, and of course the economic situation plays an important role in it. Occasional sex workers, which we find more in the clinic where we are now, they are much less aware because they don't see themselves as a sex worker. They just they go in sex when they need it because for money to pay the studies or for other reasons.
The war currently ravaging much of the country has forced massive displacements of people. Rape has reportedly been widespread in the conflict areas. The economy is in perpetual crisis, and for many, occasional prostitution is the only way to survive. There are strong circumstantial links between conflict and the spread of HIV/AIDS in the DRC. Leonard Tapsoba of the World Health Organization in Kinshasa.
There are at least 7 foreign armies in the country. I cannot say that all soldiers are bearing. We all know that the armies are a favorable factor for AIDS spreading. In 1 year, there are a lot of street children, even in Kinshasa, due to several reasons. And one of the reasons is that some of these children are orphans because their parents died from AIDS. It's a lot of challenges.
Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook, in Kinshasa, the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. More than 40 reporters in 14 states and on 4 continents are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. Free Speech Radio News only stays on the air with the financial support of community radio stations and donations from listeners like you. You can find out how to support Free Speech Radio News by going to our website, www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Or you can email us at pnnstrikers@igc.org. You can also send a tax-deductible contribution to Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship, 2210 Curtis Street, Apartment A, Berkeley, California. The zip is 94702. Free Speech Radio News is produced by Aaron Glantz. Headlines editor is Randy Zimmerman. Technical producer, Jade Paget-Seekins. Technical assistant, Matt Martin. We had web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. This newscast is produced at WMNF Radio in Tampa and the Independent Media Center in New York. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Please tune in again tomorrow for another edition of Free Speech Radio News.